Hey, Kenneth.
Hey, Will.
How's it going?
Going good. I mean, the semester's off to a great start, and I'm really looking forward to this new season of The Fly.
Yeah, season 14 should be a blast. And just looking outside right now, it's a little cloudy, a little gloomy, but leaves are changing, and it just really feels like a season of change, just like in the Biden administration.
Right, and after Biden's former chief of staff stepped down a few months ago, we were lucky enough to have the opportunity to interview him, Ron Klain, here at Georgetown.
That's right. Former alum. He also worked as Al Gore's chief of staff, and he worked on the campaigns for Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. And we were very fortunate enough to sit down with him and ask him some questions.
Yeah, I mean, there's really nothing in Washington that this guy hasn't done. So it was a really great opportunity to get to lean more into what his life was like, is like.
It's true. Well, we hope you enjoy, and go ahead and take a listen.
Welcome back, everybody, to the first episode of our new season of The Fly podcast. We are joined by our special guest, Ron Klain. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome. So we'll start first with questions related to Georgetown, since you're an alum. And the first question is, what dorm did you live in your first year?
Darnell Hall. Fourth floor Darnell Hall.
Ooh. Okay. So Wiseys, Weissmuller's, yeah. Georgetown Classic. What's your go-to order?
I don't really have a go-to order at Weissmuller's, gotcha. I gotta say.
Gotcha.
Understandable. Favorite professor during your time here?
Favorite professor is Valerie Earle, who since has passed away, unfortunately, but had a lot of great professors here, but she was my favorite one, no question about it.
Makes sense. And now we also heard that you met your wife here at Georgetown. Can you tell us the story of how you met?
Sure. I was on 4th Darnell, she was in 5th Darnell. At that time, all the floors were gender segregated. And the first time we moved into the dorms, they had a mixer. And up on the 5th floor of Darnell Hall, and we were playing party games and whatnot. And after a while, I left, and she was busy taking out she was just moving into her room, as we all were, and she was taking out trash from her room. Trash cans were right there by the elevators and the staircase. And we ran into each other and started talking, and that's how we met. The very first night we moved into the dorms at Darnell Hall.
Wow, so freshman sweetheart.
Freshman sweetheart, no question about it.
That's amazing.
So next we'll pivot to your time as chief of staff. Obviously, you've had a very long relationship with President Joe Biden, knowing him for nearly 3 decades, starting from your time on the Judiciary Committee. Just curious, how has your relationship with him evolved over these decades?
Well, I went to work for him in 1986 while I was still in law school. And, I've gotten a lot older and more senior. I was a junior staffer when I started, obviously. And, I know very well what makes him tick, what information he needs to make a decision, what sort of follow-up questions he's likely to ask. And so I think that experience with him made me better prepared to be his chief of staff and to help run the White House in a way that was consistent with what he wanted to try to get done.
Absolutely. Makes sense. Well, what's your favorite behind-the-scenes Biden story? What don't we know the public about Joe Biden?
Well, I think a lot of it's out there. There have been a couple of books written about the Biden administration, a new one out this week by Franklin Foer, a very good book. And so I think a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff has now become in front of the scenes. But what I'll say is he is as nice in private as he seems in public. He always would ask about family. He was always very kind to my children. And, he just really takes an interest in the people who work with him and people he'd meet along the country. But I think what is semi-public is that he had a stutter as a young child, worked hard to overcome it. And because that's well known in the stuttering community, a lot of young kids with stutter problems would come to meet him at different events. And he would take down their phone numbers and he would call them periodically to try to help them coach them through it and tell them that he could overcome it, they could overcome it, and help them deal with the anxiety of the stutter. And so he has dozens of young mentees around the country who he's helping manage their stutters.
So the question that's on a lot of people's mind when looking at Biden for 2024 and even Biden now is his age. Did you feel like that is a real problem for Biden? How do you feel like his age affects him in the Oval Office?
Well, I think age will be an issue in the campaign, but I think the flip side of age is experience. I think what he's acquired over his years in the Senate, as vice president, now as president, is a great deal of experience, a great deal of wisdom. And I think we undervalue those things as a society and maybe undervalue those things in a president. We have too much a little bit of a West Wing view of the presidency, that our president should just be quippy. And it's important for our president to be wise. And I saw the president make very hard decisions, and with a lot of wisdom, a lot of experience, a lot of judgment that others didn't have, based on his years of experience. So I think it's an asset for him as a president of the United States.
Absolutely.
Perfect. So now we'll transition to your role as chief of staff specifically. Obviously, it's a job with a lot of different challenges, but if you had to describe a typical day, if there is one, what would it be and what would it look like?
Well, a typical day would be long and hard. You know, I'd start early in the morning, come into the White House early, review the daily intelligence briefing, and then have a meeting with the senior most staff and then the broader senior staff before the president would enter the Oval Office at 9, where I'd sit with him for his intelligence briefing. And then we'd go into other kinds of briefings with the president in the morning. I would receive from him his decision book. Every night he would take home hundreds of pages of memos they had to read and make decisions on. And then he would bring them back in the morning. We'd take some time to go through the decisions. He'd hand me the ones he decided. He would tell me which ones he needed more information on, what he needed to know before he could make a decision. So we'd get that organized. Then usually most days in the afternoons, the president would have a public event, some kind of remarks or meeting with a foreign leader or something that would be public. So I'd participate in that. Preparing him for that, or you know, making sure we were all square away on that. And then I'd come in and meet with him at the end of the day to go over what was going to happen the next day and to deal with follow-ups to any things he'd give me that morning out of the decision book. And then usually I'd have a bunch of meetings with the staff after that and get myself ready for the next day. So the day started early, they went late. It was a lot of hard work, but I'm proud of the results we got.
So as the chief of staff, you were the gatekeeper, as I've heard Chris Whipple has called it, the gatekeeper of the president's time. How did you manage requests for Biden's time and attention?
Well, there's a famous chief of staff saying, if you want to see the president, my job is to say no. If you need to see the president, my job is to make sure you get in. And so I was very conscious of that. The president has a number of senior aides who had what we call walk-in privileges, who could go see the president without asking me, without telling me. People who've been with him for a long time, people he trusted, who I didn't want to interfere. I want to support the president to get information from a number of different people, not just the chief of staff, to have access to different voices, and I try to really preserve that and not be a controlling chief of staff that way. So I made sure in the afternoons after the public events, we had time for him to get briefed on issues and hear from different voices. And obviously, the president liked to stay in touch with people on Capitol Hill, so we'd set aside time for him to call members of the House and Senate or meet with them. And always at the centerpiece of it was managing the core agenda, which for us when we started was fighting COVID, fighting climate change, getting the economy going again, and restoring America's place in the world. So making sure the schedule reflected those priorities was another key objective.
Makes sense.
Absolutely. And if you had to describe your tenure as chief of staff in three words, how would you do so?
Three words, hard work and results. That's three, I think.
We hyphenate.
Hyphenate hard work.
Hard work, results.
Okay.
Look, I think we had a great team. I was very lucky to have a great team. I put an emphasis on teamwork at the White House. We didn't have the kind of backbiting you've seen in other White Houses. We all got along very well. It was the most diverse team ever to serve a president. First time ever in history that a majority of the White House staff was female. Majority of the senior staff was female. The cabinet was evenly divided between men and women. We had representation in proportion to their population of African-Americans and Hispanics. So I thought it was very important to have a diverse team. It brought diverse points of view to the table, put issues on the table that might otherwise not be on the table, and added to the quality of the people that worked at the White House and the excellence, I think, of the advice we were able to give the president.
So what qualities of your own do you think helped you the most in your role as chief of staff to do all of those things that you just described?
Well, I think that, I had worked in the White House a number of times before. I was relatively old for a chief of staff at age 60, usually someone that's in their 40s or early 50s. I had a lot of experience. I had served under 9 chiefs of staff before I became chief of staff, so I kind of knew how other people did the job. And I think that background, that experience really helped me.
Absolutely.
Perfect. So now we'll transition more into issue-specific things that you covered as chief of staff. First of all, which is the Supreme Court. During your time serving as an advisor to President Bill Clinton, you were obviously very influential. with getting Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the court, and for Joe Biden, you were very influential with getting Ketanji Brown Jackson on the court. Can you kind of describe what that process is like and what goes into shaping a successful nominee for the Supreme Court?
Well, President Biden had done something historic, which was during the South Carolina primary, he had pledged that he would put a black woman on the Supreme Court. We never had a black woman on the Supreme Court in American history, and it seemed like a big oversight. So he made that promise. So that shaped his search for a Supreme Court nominee. We knew he had made that promise. So when he came to office, we focused early on finding qualified black women to get positions on the lower federal courts to burnish their credentials for potential elevation to the Supreme Court. And President Biden's first nominee to any judicial position was Ketanji Brown Jackson to fill the vacancy on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that Merrick Garland gave up when he became Attorney General. So she was his very first nominee for the very first judicial vacancy. And so you could say we were getting her ready for a possible Supreme Court vacancy by getting her on the D.C. Circuit. She was someone who was widely known in legal circles. She'd been someone the president had President Obama had considered for as a Supreme Court nominee because she was a trial court judge. He'd considered her when Justice Scalia passed away. He ultimately nominated Merrick Garland for that vacancy, but he thought about Jackson. Generally, trial court judges don't get nominated to the Supreme Court. Usually, you have to be an appellate judge. So President Biden elevated her from the trial court in D.C. to the appellate bench in D.C., which is one of the most prestigious courts in the country, with the thought that she was ready to do the job, but we were going to burnish her credentials with that additional experience. I thought from the time that we got the vacancy, I thought that she was the logical candidate. She had stellar credentials. She was a great person. I knew her personally. A lot of other people in the White House did. She was highly regarded in the legal community. I thought she'd do a great job on the Supreme Court. She was someone that we all recommended to President Biden. He interviewed a number of candidates. He immediately took a liking to her, and then we set out to do the job of selling her nomination, consulting with people on the Hill to make sure we could have the vote so it wouldn't be a big fight, and that you know we would try to get her through as easily as possible.
Perfect. So since you were last on the podcast, you're actually our third ever guest on the Fly podcast all the way back in 2017. Yeah. And you were talking about the same topic, the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
How do you think 6 years later politics around the Supreme Court have changed?
Well, I think obviously the court is more conservative than it was in 2017, because in 2017 we were in the first year of the Trump administration. Donald Trump got to put three people on the Supreme Court, and that changed the Supreme Court rather dramatically. And obviously most dramatically with the Dobbs decision, reversing Roe versus Wade. And I think that coupled with the ethical issues around Supreme Court justices taking private trips and things like that have diminished the respect the court has with the public. The court's approval rating, if you will, is the lowest it's been in recorded history. I think citizens increasingly see the court as political. It's extremely conservative, ahistorically conservative. And I think that kind of lack of balance or respect for individual rights does the court a great disservice. So I hope President Biden will get a chance to put more people on the Supreme Court and restore that balance and put the court back to where it's been historically.
Besides nominations, do you think there's a way back for the Supreme Court to become less polarizing, or is it kind of doomed right now to just continue along this path?
I think that historically when the court's kind of gone off course, it's nominations, it's vacancies on the court and replacing those justices that changes the court, and I think that's the likely path forward here now.
That makes perfect sense. Now, you also said on our last episode back 6 years ago that you were in favor of keeping the 60-vote filibuster in place for Supreme Court nominees. Now that that is no longer a thing, have your opinions changed on that at all?
Well, I mean, again, it has to go both ways. The Republicans got rid of the 60-vote filibuster threshold and confirmed a number of nominees by a hair's breadth, Brett Kavanaugh, by a single vote. If that's the rule, that's the rule. I think President Biden should be able to nominate people to the Supreme Court. And if they get 51 votes, they should be confirmed onto the Supreme Court. And so, the rules have evolved since then. And I think what's fair is fair.
Makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah. And now kind of transitioning out of the Supreme Court, you've gone on record for you saying that the most difficult day of your tenure as chief of staff was the Afghanistan withdrawal. If you feel comfortable, would you mind providing more insights into what that was like and how that felt?
Yeah, it was August 26th, 2021 specifically. We were nearing the end of the civilian evacuation. We had gotten over 100,000 people out of Kabul safely. It had looked a little bit chaotic, I know, but in the end, we had successfully conducted the largest humanitarian airlift in human history. We had rescued, as I said, more than 100,000 people from Kabul, and we were in the final few days. And as the British finished their evacuation, they were withdrawing from the Abbey Gate to the airport, and American troops went out to cover their withdrawal, and there was a terrorist attack, and we lost 13 Americans, and many others got injured in a terrorist attack. And it was just a horrible, horrible thing, because you thought we were going to get these people out of Afghanistan, we were going to get them out safely, we'd get our troops out safely, and then this terrorist attack killed 13 Americans. And it was, during the evacuation from Afghanistan, we would go down to the Situation Room every morning, the president would, every morning our time on the East Coast, and talk to the president's commanders, the military commanders on the ground in Kabul, and in the region generally, General McKenzie, the CENTCOM commander, and General Donahue, who was on the ground in Kabul, and talk to them by secure video conference every day. And he would always ask them, what else do you need to finish this mission? And we've been making progress. And I think everyone was looking forward to the mission ending with no loss of life. But then we had this horrible tragedy where we came down the sit room that morning. We had heard there had been a terrorist attack. Some Americans had been injured. And then slowly the casualty counts came in, and it got worse and worse and worse. So it was a very, very grim day. It was a very tragic day. And those people were heroes for helping so many civilians get out of Afghanistan safely. Military did an excellent job executing the evacuation. In Vietnam, when they brought people out, planes had been shot down. We were able to get all the planes out with no loss of life on getting the planes out. And again, getting more than 100,000 people out of Kabul. But the loss of life at Abbey Gate was definitely the darkest day of my 2 years there.
So after a day as difficult and as dark as that, how do you cope with what happened and move on to continue making things happen?
Well, I think, we were still not at the end yet. And I think we all realized that to honor those who lost their lives as part of this mission, the mission had to be finished successfully. It meant we had to get the remaining civilians we were evacuating out of Kabul out. We had to get the 5,000 troops we still had on the ground out safely. It was a complex situation. So the president redoubled his efforts to make sure that we had sound contingency planning in place to get, because once you got all the civilians out, then you just had the military left, and they had to also be evacuated. It wasn't like they just walked out the back door and they were at home.
Right.
So he quizzed General McKenzie and others on the plan to end the military presence at Kabul Airport, and then we went and executed that the next few days.
Makes sense. But on a purely emotional level, dealing with that type of loss, how do you guys do it? How do you do it?
Well, I cried a lot that day and the next couple of days, but we had jobs to do, and people had given their lives to make the mission a success. And with that kind of sacrifice, I think for the rest of us, just sucking up and going through it was the least we could do to respect that loss.
Makes sense.
And final question with your work as Chief of Staff is, how do you work with such thin legislative majorities? Obviously, during your time, it was very tough in the House and the Senate. What tactics do you have to kind of adapt when trying to get certain policies through?
Well, I think you have to look for places where you can bring people together. We were able to do some things on a bipartisan basis. We had to do some other things with Democrats only. We had 50 Democratic senators, which means we couldn't lose a single one. We couldn't win unless we got both Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin to both vote for a bill. And that meant a lot of outreach, a lot of hand-holding, a lot of conversations, a lot of persuasion, and a lot of hard work. And we had a great team. Steve Ricchetti, who was senior counsel to the president, oversaw our legislative affairs team. Louisa Terrell, who was the president's chief of legislative affairs, did a fantastic job, and her team was great, and people worked around the clock to make sure we had our ducks lined up and we won our major votes.
Makes sense. Now, I heard that, I was reading an article, it was talking about the difficult relationship with Joe Manchin during that time, trying to get these things passed, and it actually said that a dinner cooked by Gino Raimondo helped you guys reconcile.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So, we had reached an agreement with Senator Manchin on our legislative package in early December, and then he went out mid-December and said he was not going to honor that agreement. And we put out a tough statement, and he he was mad at me about the tough statement, and I was frustrated that he had changed his mind about the agreement we had reached. And so we went into a period of rocky relations, but I wanted to repair that, and he was gracious enough to want to repair that. Secretary Raimondo is quite a good cook, and so she took it upon herself to have us over to her house for dinner.
Okay.
And she cooked dinner for Senator Manchin, myself, and herself. We had a very robust and lively discussion about the legislative path forward.
Do you remember what you guys had for dinner? Like, what was the room like?
She made eggplant parmesan that was quite good.
Okay.
She made a roast pork, which I don't really eat, but Senator Manchin and Gina said it was very good. And, a nice salad, and we had a good time.
There you go. See, the reason I asked that is I was actually in CVS yesterday over in Wisconsin, and I ran into Secretary Raimondo in the aisle and asked her where I could help find the over-the-counter pain meds. So
yeah.
I just seeing this, the secretaries in the cabinet in such like an informal setting is something that you get to do uniquely well. There's really not that many people who get to see people in that type of setting. So I was wondering what that was like.
Secretary Raimondo is a very special person. She was a very successful governor of Rhode Island and agreed to serve in the cabinet as Commerce Secretary. Sometimes that job hasn't been that significant. The Biden administration became very significant because of the passage of the infrastructure bill. She now manages a giant sum of money that is doing broadband deployment all over the country. And because of the CHIPS and Science Act, she manages a large sum of money that's bringing domestic manufacturing of semiconductors back to the United States. And so she has a very important job in the administration. She does it very well. She's well-liked on Capitol Hill. She was a key liaison for us to Congress. Key liaison to the business community, and someone who helped deliver on the president's policies in Congress and then in implementation.
There you go. Well, with all of the chief of staff chapter over in Biden's administration, what are you most proud of walking away from it?
I think if I had to pick one thing, I would say it's our record on judicial appointments, generally not just the Supreme Court, but the lower federal courts. We got more people confirmed to the federal courts in the first year than any president since JFK. Right now, the president's put more people on the federal bench than either President Obama or President Trump had at this stage of their presidency. They're also unprecedentedly diverse. President Biden's put more black women on the U.S. Courts of Appeals than every single one of his predecessors combined. Not just more than any other predecessor, but more than every other predecessor combined.
Wow.
And diverse backgrounds, more public defenders, more people from public interest law practice, not just big corporate practices. They're excellent judges. They're going to serve for a long time. They're a big part of his legacy. I'm very proud of that. I think legislatively, I'm most proud of the Inflation Reduction Act, which we finally got done in August of 2022.
Makes sense.
That, I think is already, you see, it's dramatically changing our country's energy transition, really accelerating the deployment of wind power, solar power, electric vehicles in this country, putting us back in the lead on fighting climate change among the nations of the world, which is where we should be, creating a lot of jobs in the country and building our clean energy future. And then I was very proud of our result in the midterm elections. It's an unprecedentedly positive result for an incumbent president. He had to go back to FDR to find a president who did that well in his first midterm. And it reflected, I think, the soundness of our strategic approach to politics and policy.
Sounds like there's a lot to be proud of.
There was, yes.
Absolutely. Now, transitioning out of chief of staff, that role, you've obviously been involved in a lot of debate prep on the campaign trail for not only President Biden, but other candidates as well. We're just curious, what is kind of the behind the scenes like with debate prep and what does that look like for you?
I firmly believe in practice. And so my first candidate I helped prepare for debate was Bill Clinton in the 1992 campaign. And what I've always believed in is if you practice debate exchanges, if you practice the likely questions, likely answers, what the other candidate will say, how you respond to that, your candidate's as ready as they can be for a spontaneous and unrehearsed event. It's a high-stakes event. It's the most watched political event of the campaign year. There aren't that many undecided voters left when you get to September and October, but those that are, can be the difference makers. And also, your own supporters watch to see, reaffirm their choices. So I think even though people say, well, they're not that important because people have already made up their minds, well, maybe, but maybe not. I think that thinking hard about what the other person will say and being prepared for comebacks, that's a very important part of debates. Debates are media events. They're not like you know, Oxford-style debates and not like the kind of debates that the Philodemic Society holds here at Georgetown.
Were you a part of the Philodemic Society?
No, I was not.
Gotcha.
They're not like that. They're media exchanges. They're kind of exchanges of talking points and whatnot. But I think the public gets a good look at these candidates and a good chance to see what they're like, how they interact with one another, and what their ideas are. So I think the debates are interesting and very significant.
So you were on Hillary Clinton's campaign team in 2016.
Yes, I was.
Helping her debate prep. How do you even prepare for a debate with Donald Trump?
Well, look, I think the thing about President Trump is he, you know, his personality is erratic, but his material is very repetitive.
Gotcha.
He, you know, if you turn on a Trump rally tomorrow night, he'll be telling the same stories he was telling in 2015.
Right.
And so what he's going to say isn't that surprising. The fact that he has the audacity to say it is what's surprising. The fact that he's willing to stand up there and lie and say it is surprising. But the specific lies and the specific ridiculous claims are ones he's made time and time and time again.
Right.
And so you have to expose the candidate to those things and prepare what you want, what you think he or she should say in response to that. And I thought Secretary Clinton did a very good job in the 2016 debates.
Absolutely. So then would you consider that maybe the 2016 debates your most memorable experience on debate prep, or is there another story you feel that's your most memorable? In that
the most memorable one turned out to be 2020, okay, where we went to the first debate between Biden and Trump in Cleveland, and the President Trump had COVID and we didn't know it. Oof. And that was before there were vaccinations, and when we found out Trump had COVID, I was thought a miracle that none of the rest of us got sick, because not only did Trump have COVID, but several members of his team had COVID at that event and refused to wear masks.
Yikes.
And so that was a memorable experience. It had nothing to do with the debate itself.
Right.
So that was a highly memorable experience. I think in terms of the debating itself, you know, I think they're all, each one of them's memorable. You know, President Obama had a rough first debate in Denver against Mitt Romney, and that was a very memorable event for sad reasons in 2012.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. The debate world's a very interesting world.
It is. I taught a course here at Georgetown about presidential debates in the government department for a number of years, from like 2011 to 2017. And I enjoyed it. I think the students enjoyed it.
So what does the future hold then? Are you going to come back and be a professor, or Biden 2024 campaign maybe?
I'll certainly help President Biden in his 2024 campaign any way I can from the outside. I'm practicing law now. I'm a law partner in a firm called O'Melveny & Myers. Gotcha. I'm enjoying that. And I haven't started teaching again because teaching is a lot of work. And I need to get better rooted in my law practice before I take it on. I really enjoy teaching at Georgetown. The students are great. I always say that the students at Georgetown today are much more talented and intelligent than my classmates I went to school with in the 1980s. But teaching is hard work, and the students put in work, and the teachers need to put in work. And so I need to get a little more grounded in my post-White House life before I come back to the Hilltop.
Absolutely. And speaking of the post-White House life, how has the private sector been? Obviously, you've worked for O'Melveny & Myers before, but kind of how's the transition been? What's that like for you?
Well, it's a big change, obviously. I'm enjoying it, though. You know, being in law practice is hard work, but not nearly as hard as being at the White House. So my hours are more manageable, it's interesting. I like my colleagues at the firm. I like the things we work on, and I'm enjoying law practice. Being a lawyer.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it seems great. We have a minute left here.
Okay.
So we just want to ask one or two quick lightning round questions.
Let's do it. Let's do lightning round.
So we heard that you were part of your high school's brain game trivia team.
I was, yes.
If you were to compete in a trivia competition today, what category do you think would be your best?
I think U.S. history.
Okay.
Makes the most sense, given your background.
Yeah, there you go.
And then also, if you were to write a memoir about your political journey now that you've retired as chief of staff, what would you title it?
I don't know. I'm not in the book writing business, so I haven't really thought about a book or a title. So I'm going to have to pass on that one.
Is there one in the works?
There is not one in the works.
Oh, all right. And then last and not least, but last, what is your go-to stress relief?
My go-to stress relief is time with my family, time with the kids. We travel a lot together. We were all at the U.S. Open last night, so that was a good was hot there, but it was good stress relief. So time with the kids is my go-to stress relief.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today, Mr. Klein. We really appreciate your time.
Happy to be here. Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Fly. You can find us on social media at The Fly Georgetown. If you enjoyed our conversation, make sure to subscribe to The Fly and leave a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or SoundCloud. Our researchers are Kenneth Jackson, Julian Zeitlinger, Abigail Asadi, and Chase Dobson. Our communications team is Andrea Smith, Austin Culpepper, Darius Wagner, and Sarah Sverdlov. Our production team is Will Hayes and David Grice. Original theme music is composed by Aiden Ng and Bella Carlucci. And I'm Fiona Gallagher, Managing Director of the Pod. The Fly is brought to you by the Georgetown University Institute of Politics and Public Service, and is made possible by the McCourt School of Public Policy. Thanks so much for listening, and fly with you soon.